What's up, everybody? Welcome to Draft Chaff. This is episode number 196. My name is Zach. I'm one of your hosts, and joining me, as per usual, Ben Fisher. What's up, dude?
A lot. I mean, this is a really important episode. People have been, clamoring about it in Discord all week. Everyone knows what's happening. That's right. We finally got a preview card for Outlaws at Thunder Junction. Oh, man, I can't wait to tell everyone about this. Go ahead. Read the card.
You do this to me every set.
It's planes.
I don't know how I don't see it.
It's planes.
Anyway, set.
Yeah. This is an actual important episode, but it's not because of that. This is Zach's last episode. For now.
It is.
Until I can drag him back.
Yeah, it is. And what Ben didn't want to tell you in an intro like this was that our preview card was Sol Ring, and yes, they're printing it back into standard and back into standard for the first time.
Finally.
No. Yeah, it's my last episode. This is the last episode of the show for the foreseeable future, at least in this format. We'll get to that in a little bit. But we did talk about it last week. If you're brand new to the show, I'm sorry.
Bad timing on your part.
Yeah, you should have picked better timing, but check out last week's episode for more context on what's happening here. But yeah, it's bittersweet. I think, I'm definitely going to miss it. It's been the last 4 years of my life. And so there's definitely going to be some adjusting in terms of, filling that time. But I think it's the appropriate move. And again, I kind of talked through all that last week, but we've got something fun. Before we get into that, our usual housekeeping. Look, the show may be ending in this form, but the Discord's sticking around. The community is going to be where it is. Ben and I will still be around. Ben, for sure. I'll probably be a little quieter, but I'll still be there. And we've had actually one of our Discord members, Nathan, jumped up and started a March Chaffness bracket, which has been really cool. We've been seeing a lot of action, people voting in there to kind of elevate, if you're familiar with like the March Madness style brackets for March Madness basketball. We're doing that, but with all of our Draft Chaff heroes, and it's been fun. It's been striking up a lot of conversations, so it's been cool. If you want to get in that, I think the finals are like right now, or are we still in the semis? I can't actually remember.
Probably by the time this episode releases, yeah, I think the finals will be happening.
So, yeah, definitely check that out, and otherwise jump in the Discord just to say hi and post about all the different things you're doing in MTG. And of course, we do also have our Patreon. That's not really going anywhere. It may be changing in sort of what the tiers look like, but you can check that out at patreon.com/draftchaffpod. Again, huge thanks to everybody who supported us over the last 4 years. Continue to make this something that was doable, really. I can't thank you guys enough for that. And I look forward to seeing how Ben kind of shifts it and what it looks like going forward. But it's still there. So you can definitely go continue to support Ben in the ways that he is going to continue the Draft Chaff legacy. Speaking of, at this point, we would normally switch to our crack a draft type thing. But if you want to check that out, you're going to have to go into the episode description, click that YouTube link, and go see the video that Ben's putting up to partner with this episode and make that transition over to YouTube more full time. So if you're interested in that crack a draft type thing, check it out over there. All right, so Ben, for this episode, we don't have a proper main topic. Instead, we thought it would be valuable and fun and enjoyable for all of you and us, frankly, to take a walk down memory lane. We're going to time walk ourselves here, go back to the beginning of the show, and actually just kind of play clips from some of our favorite episodes, some of the episodes that really stand out to us as having been fun to record or were well received by you, the listener. And I think it's going to be a fun episode. If you're just joining us or you've really only joined us recently or maybe in the last year or two, there should be some stuff that you haven't heard yet. And hopefully there will be an increase in audio quality from beginning to end because we're going to be starting with our first episode ever. But if you do want to see exactly what is from each, like which clips are from what episodes, check the episode description. We'll have timestamps in there that will highlight which episodes they come from, and you can go listen to the episode in full. We're not removing any of the backlog of episodes, so you have our entire backlog still to listen to if you haven't already heard every episode.
Yeah, don't worry. There won't be any sort of past in flames where all those, you know, get destroyed. Think of this as more of like a dig through time, right? Where we're going on some sort of treasure cruise. Oh,
that's such a good name, too.
We're going for like an ancestral recall almost of pleasant memories and almost to regrowth some of these back into our hand mind. I don't know. I'm running out.
I real talk, though, I kind of think we should call the episode Dig Through Time.
Yeah, you're right. All right, we're swapping on the fly then. Forget Time Walk. This is Dig Through Time.
So good.
I mean, we did some digging. We found some really good episodes. And honestly, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to listen back to the first one. That's
it's going to be difficult to get through.
Pretty cringe, but just in audio quality alone.
Look, if going back to the first episode wasn't cringe, then we did something wrong, because that at least shows that we grew somehow.
We always said the goal was to change people's magic play style, whether it was making them better or worse, you know, by being more like us or less like us.
So, yeah, we're going to show clips or play clips from about 7 episodes. We hope you enjoy. And we'll be back at the end to just wrap things up and you know, kind of do a bit of a send-off and such.
You're listening to Draft Chat. Episode 1.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Draft Chat Podcast, and I'm Zach Hackett. I have with me here Ben Fisher.
Testing. Is this thing on?
You're on. Yeah, it's here.
Yeah. Cool. Man, a podcast. We're in the big leagues now.
Yeah, so we decided to start Draft Chat because drafting is our favorite thing to do in Magic and pretty much any game ever. It's kind of just awesome. And we enjoy improving. We enjoy learning about the game and hearing from others about the game. So we just figured perhaps some of our thoughts or insights might be able to help others, and we can get some good conversations going. So, Ben, do you want to run us through what we're talking about today?
Yeah, so we're going to be going over the Arena Cube. This cube is really fun, first of all. It's quarantine. Everyone's at home a lot, you know, spending a lot of time on Arena. So thankfully, they decided to give us, you know, one of Magic's finest formats, the Cube, which is a collection of some of the best, you know, impactful cards from recent sets, or ones that they know people have fun with, and it's kind of like a set of the best of the best. So naturally, they also added human drafting for it, which is pretty sweet, given that's pretty new for Arena. So you know, we're just going to kind of talk about our thoughts on Arena Cube. Unfortunately, it's going to be disappearing probably before this episode comes out, but I have a feeling it'll be back in the future.
Yeah, for sure. So definitely by the time this episode airs, Arena Cube will no longer be on Arena, which is super sad because it's a fantastic format. But hopefully, if you're listening to this in the future, the Cube would be back and possibly updated. But most of what we're going to talk about is probably going to hold true still, even if they update it. So we're going to get right into that. But before we do, I'm going to run through a quick what's the pick for a nice pack one, pick one of Arena Cube.
Yeah, so all of you listening, all, I don't know, -2 of you, if you want to send us some what's the picks, if you ever come across just a really interesting decision in drafting, Zach and I love drafting. We love doing this. It's, like we said, our favorite thing to be doing. And sometimes you'll come across something that's a stumper. And you're like, well, what is the pick here? Sometimes I'll send them in to, you know, the greats on Twitter and, you know, pray that they get back to me in time for me to do something useful for it. But, you know, I think we can talk about that ourselves. We know a good amount about, you know, these formats and what we can do with it. So we had a pack one, pick one here to discuss. Of course, it doesn't have to be a pack one, pick one. But in this case, it left us with some pretty interesting options. So I'm just going to run through the pack and we're going to talk about it. So first up, we have Shalai, Voice of Plenty, got Voracious Great Shark, Liliana's Contract, Priest of Forgotten Gods, Bone Crusher Giant, Dark Dweller Oracle, Phoenix of Ash, Dryad of the Hidden Grove, Voracious Hydra, Chromatic Lantern, Labyrinth of Skophos, Banishing Light, Beanstalk Giant, Thrashing Brontodon, and Weaselback Redcap. So, Zach, what's sticking out at you here?
All right, well, I mean, I see this pack, and I immediately want to scoop that Chromatic Lantern. It's a colorless card that makes all your lands, and it ramps you, and as we're going to get into, the ramp deck in this format is kind of the nuts. So I'm looking at Chromatic Lantern. I also like the Dryad. Shalai's been pretty awesome for me in this format as well. But I think I'm just hard on Chromatic Lantern.
Yeah, I think there's a few things that stick out here. So those of you that are playing Arena Cube will know that the red deck is pretty tough to beat when it comes together. And I've actually noticed that in this format, adventures have been pretty good ways to get kind of card advantage, even through mulligans. So Bonecrusher Giant and Beanstalk Giant both kind of stick out for that here. They're both very good in their respective archetypes. But that being said, my favorite thing to do in this format is activate Golos. And there's two things in this pack that help us do that, Chromatic Lantern and the Dryad. So between the two, they're pretty close. Having it on a body opens up to removal, and not having it on a body sometimes lets you get overrun by the red and white decks. I think you can make a good argument for the Lantern, the Dryad, or even Shalai here. The blue-white deck, or even just a deck that can play Shalai. Sometimes you just slam that against mono red, and the guy across the table has no idea what to do.
Yeah, I honestly think Chromatic Lantern's a pick here. You kind of touched on a lot of the highlights that I was thinking of and brought up the red deck. I mean, you could totally take Weaselback Redcap here.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good pickup too.
you're definitely not taking Redcap. Chromatic Lantern.
If you're gonna go to the red deck. If you're going to take the red deck, I think you're going to go with the Bonecrusher Giant here. I think that's something just about this format, too. You can kind of force your way into stuff or see what's open. Kind of, you can mess around in the draft a little bit. Personally, when I was actually doing this draft, I took the Dryad. It ended up turning into a five-color Niv-Mizzet trash fire. But we won't talk about that.
Lantern would have been amazing in that deck.
Well, the Dryad was pretty good in it too, but the rest of the draft didn't go as well as I would have liked, but this one was still a fine pickup. So other cards in this pack that are interesting, at least, the Priest of the Forgotten Gods, pretty good for the black-red sacrifice deck, same with the Dark Dweller Oracle. And the Voracious Great Shark is kind of a good top end in the blue-green or some of the more controlling blue lists.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now we're gonna move on to the meat of this podcast. We're gonna talk about the actual archetypes and such.
Meat.
One thing to note about Arena Cube in particular is that a lot of the good decks are super synergistic, so you're gonna want to look out for a lot of the payoffs, as we were kind of talking about with that pack. Particularly, say you're in red black, you're gonna want to try to pick up that Priest of Forgotten Gods. It's kind of a linchpin of the deck, and you're gonna want to pay attention to a lot of the other linchpins that can be found in the deck in the various archetypes that are available to you. A lot of them, which we'll get into, don't have alternatives. And so those are going to be super important if you want to move into a specific archetype.
Yeah. So unique effects, stuff like mana dorks, can't really, replace those with other ones. They're a pretty important pickup for, say, the green deck or anything trying to go big. Or like a board wipe, for example, is going to be pretty integral for a control deck. So we're just going to get started with the major archetypes here and kind of share some of our thoughts on them. I mean, we've been playing this format for a while. I'd like to say that I'm a format expert on this. Let me see. I've got 44 hours logged with 17 7-win runs and a 67% win rate. So I think I've got a little background in Arena Cube, huh?
Yeah, for sure. You've definitely played more of this format than I have, so I'm interested to hear your takes and also maybe chime in a bit myself.
Oh man, I have a bunch of hot takes on this stuff. So, the first deck...
This week, we are joined by Marshall Sutcliffe, the original limited resource himself. How's it going, Marshall?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely.
thanks for taking the time out of your day to join us. And I think we have some shenanigans ahead for us today.
I'm down for shenanigans.
Here, I can fire one at you real quick then. This is something that's been on my mind and probably a lot of our listeners' minds too, if we want to get personal, so to speak. So how have you been like dealing with mental health through the pandemic? Because this is something that I've been going back and forth on, trying new things, like trying to focus on self-care, but then trying to double check if I even know what self-care is. So how have you been doing through the pandemic? How has it impacted you? And what have you been doing to stay on top of it?
See, there's a good question. There we go. Now we're getting personal. Yeah. So it's been a really interesting ride for me for the pandemic, because when it first started, I was fine. In fact, I felt some amount of relief because I was getting pretty burnt out on travel. I'd been just traveling for 8 years in a row and it was getting to be a bit much. So when I found out that my next couple of events were, I wasn't going to travel for them, I kind of felt like, well, that could be worse. Of course, I was naive at the time and also thought that the pandemic was going to last just, you know, some number of months rather than a year plus or whatever. So I kind of settled in, and, you know, it also gave me something to focus on, you know, as far as like making sure I had all the supplies I needed and that I was going to be good to set everything up here at home and work from home. And, you know, it just kind of recenters you a little bit. And so I was feeling fine. I started working more on the YouTube channel I mentioned before, the Watches one. I did extra episodes of the podcast. I did extra draft videos for people just because I felt like it was needed at the time and like just would be a good thing to do. You know, so I was like pretty motivated and doing well. And then at some point I hit like a mental breaking point that I didn't really anticipate. And man, it was bad. I felt terrible. I was depressed for sure, which I've never really struggled with depression before in my life outside of like, you know, like when somebody dies or something and you feel sad for a long time, you know, that kind of thing has happened. But I kind of felt like that was natural, but I've never felt it. I've never felt depressed from like for a reason I didn't understand. And that happened here. And it was bad. I felt awful, like really the worst I felt mentally in my whole life easily. Where, you know, you just wake up and you're just like empty, you know, and I was strong enough, smart enough, aware of enough. I don't know what what trait it is that led me to do this, but I kept doing the things that I do because I know that at some point I'm going to get out on the other side of this feeling and I'm going to want those things to be intact, like the podcast and videos and stuff like that. Yeah. But the truth of the matter is I didn't want to do them. You know, I had effectively no motivation whatsoever to do anything. I would stay in bed a lot, you know, feel sad all day, just really, really, really down. And it was scary. Like again, being not used to that, it definitely changes the way that you think about mental health. When it comes to, you know, a lot of times you'll hear people kind of pull the old school thing of like, oh, just pull yourself up and get to work and do your thing. It doesn't work like that. You know, there were definitely times where, if I needed to do my job during that time, I wouldn't have been able to. Now, I was able to get myself together for the most part for the jobs that I needed to do, but that was close. Like you know, I really didn't feel good about doing it. I had to really push myself. And I've had to do a lot of introspection about why I feel this way and what was going on. And, you know, I've been seeing a therapist for actually a while, like kind of off and on, but I started making sure to see her like once a week for sure, no matter what, right? Because like, I'm not doing well. Like I have to look at myself and go, you're not doing well, dude. Like this isn't the normal you at all. And there's something going on. And, you know, it turns out that the pandemic itself has a huge blanket effect on most people where they kind of use up their reserves. And then when those are gone, you're very, very vulnerable. And that's how I was. And I didn't realize it until I didn't realize the effect it was having on me until I really kind of crashed out. And again, that was a real struggle for me. And I've been able to just sort of keep on the path and keep working at it. And after quite a while, I've started to now, the past, I would say 2 months or so, I've kind of gone back to feeling like pretty normal. Like I'm not good, I wouldn't say, like compared to before where like I get to see people and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm able to work now, like every day, like I've been putting tons of time in on all of my magic and watch stuff. So I've really felt more productive and better about it. And I feel, I don't feel that real deep depth of sadness that I had felt for a while. So I feel really good about that, but that took a lot of work. Like I had to really become a lot more self-aware during this time. You know, and it makes sense. It's like, it's weird because when you're living the life, you don't really think about it and it's like hard to understand. But if I were to explain to you what happened to me in the wake of the pandemic, you would be like, well, yeah, you're probably pretty depressed at this point. Like primarily, you know, I travel so much that it leaves my home life not quite as robust as a normal person who doesn't travel that much, right? Where you have like a circle of friends and family members and things that you do every week and places that you like to go and all that stuff. I have that, but it's like a stripped down version because every Friday I'm heading off to the airport and I'm gone all weekend. And that's when a lot of the social stuff happens at home, you know? And I'm older now too. So like a lot of my friends have kids and family. So, you know, the friends that I grew up with and that I hung out with for most of my life, you know, they're busy, real, you know, family life busy. And so I don't get to just pop by and watch a football game with them anymore or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. And so my social circles exist in the Magic community. They're my friends from coverage. They're my friends from traveling for Magic events, the players and the judges and the people, you know, the professional players and the people in those circles are my people. And so I was getting all of my social fix when I was on the road and interacting with them. And that got stripped away from me in a heartbeat. And I had to look around here and go, dude, you've let it go here, right? Like you have not maintained the friendships and the things that you need to have like a robust sort of full life at home. A lot of your life is on the road. And that I didn't like that, right? And also it meant that I didn't have as much here to lean on when I needed it. And so, you know, if I would explain that to you, you'd be like, well, duh, like, you know, you've been traveling for 8 years straight. You don't have, you know, the robust circle here that you once had. And on top of it, I work from home. Like I have for this whole time. I don't have that structure, right? There's something to be said, even if you don't love your job, to getting up and needing to be a place and somebody expecting you to be there and you feeling like you got something done and you change your scenery and, you know, you place yourself, humans place themselves in like kind of a hierarchy societally, right? And it doesn't matter where you fit in. It's just that you do fit in, right? Like you might be the lowest rung at your new job, but you know where you stand. That person's my boss. I work with that person. Oh, there goes the big CEO, right? And you kind of get a sense of yourself relative to other people, right? And maybe you're the big dog and I own this company and I fire people and hire people and I make the decisions. And then there's other people that look up to you, right? And you might be in the middle, right? Like most people are somewhere in the middle. They land somewhere in the middle. And I don't have that. It's just me, right? Like when it comes to LR, when it comes to the stuff that I do, it's like I either do it or it doesn't happen. Yeah. And I do get to hang out with Luis. I do get to, you know, spend a couple hours with him a week. And I talk to him every day online, but like I only get to really hang out with him for the show. And then of course we're doing the show. So we're working, you know? So when you add up all that stuff and then you layer the pandemic and the stress that our country's in right now, politically and with the pandemic, it's a lot. It is a real lot. And I didn't recognize that. And I just kind of kept plowing forward thinking I was okay. And I wasn't. And when I hit that wall, I hit it hard and it really sucked. Yeah. And I feel extremely grateful that I'm feeling a little bit better now because I don't want to go back to that place. It sucks. It's really bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thanks for sharing. And we're glad to hear that you're kind of back on the other side of things now. I'll say, so I'm a full-time teacher right now. And
That's true. I'm going to have to start getting a little more technical with my questions here, aren't I? This one, I don't think you can find any loopholes in. What's in your fridge?
What is in my fridge? Unfortunately, not as much as there should be. I've got a leftover steak in there, uncooked still, from my dinner for my birthday. We've got two different types of non-milk milk, nice. Almond and oat, I believe.
Good stuff.
We've got pickles because everybody needs pickles. And
the dip in the milk.
Naturally.
What?
And
what'd you say?
There's some potato salad in there. And a miscellaneous assortment of sauces and or dips, I think.
Yeah, that's solid like fridge.
A rough estimate. I think we've got some like romaine lettuce and stuff in there too, but honestly, we need to go shopping, so there's not a lot in there.
Fair enough. Who's your favorite co-host?
Definitely Marshall Sutcliffe. 100%. It's got to be Marshall Sutcliffe. Does he count as a co-host? I guess not. I mean, he was a guest. I guess that doesn't count. Well, but on a technicality, it would have to be you. I've never had another co-host, so I could say myself. Yes. I suppose I'm my own co-host.
Oh my God. You found a goddamn loophole. All right. Cut that. How about best joke I've ever made?
Ever made? Dude, you make way too many jokes for me to store all of them.
Yeah, that's this the episode, I think. It is pretty good. We're going to take it back to a classic. If you were a potato, you know the rest. Everyone listening, you know the rest. How would you be prepared and served?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of curly fries. I think curly fries are a pleasure that is too good for this world. And I would love to be a good curly fry. And, you know, with maybe some good kind of dipping sauce. I mean, ketchup's good, but like, I think we could do better. Maybe some kind of aioli of some kind. That's a pretty good option to me. I had smashed potatoes for my birthday dinner. And for those that don't know what smashed potatoes are, you essentially take baby potatoes and you parboil them and you smash them with a potato masher and they like break open, but you still have the skins involved and they're not like completely mashed. And then you throw them in the oven with like seasonings and stuff on. And they get crispy, but they still kind of have a mashed potato consistency. They're really good.
I'll be honest. When you told me earlier that you had smashed potatoes, I thought I just misheard you. And I thought you said mashed potatoes.
Nope. Smashed potatoes. They're delicious.
Yeah, no, that makes more sense. What is a birthday gift that you've always wanted but never received?
Okay, so I'm really bad about gifts because I typically will buy everything that I want and or need prior to big events. I do this with Christmas all the time. So like Christmas will roll around and my parents or like loved ones will be like, hey, what do you want for Christmas? I'm like, nah, I don't know. I just bought everything. But what is something I've always wanted and never received? I don't think I want things long enough to have always wanted the same thing. I definitely wanted a Black Lotus at some point. Never got one of those. Yeah, I guess that's probably it. I don't know. I don't really ever want very much for my birthday. I feel weird like wanting things for my birthday.
Mr. Humble over here.
I don't know why. It's like I have no issues with like telling people I want things for other holidays, but for my birthday, I'm just like, it's just another day. I don't know.
Birthdays are kind of weird.
Why are you giving me something for being born? I just like, I didn't have anything to do with that.
Yeah, you're not wrong there. I was going to like quickly scribble down whatever it is that you said, but Black Lotus, give me like 30 years.
Yeah, okay.
I'll get on that one.
I'll let you know.
I think it'd be more likely that one of us would find a Black Lotus, right? Like if we took on someone's old collection or if we're looking through and we'd happen to like stumble upon one. That's just the dream, right? Like you're looking through a collection and someone just has like five unsleeved dusty lotuses, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I think I'd be really disappointed if that happened because I'd inevitably find one that would be in like really bad condition and wouldn't be worth anything or would be worth very little.
Honestly, a damaged Black Lotus is still, you know, that's still a few rent payments.
It's probably true.
What's your favorite interview question?
This one.
Oh.
No, I don't know. I like questions that get kind of, I guess, detailed, like things that are different. I feel like there are a lot of interviews, and Marshall kind of said the same thing when he was on the show. Like a lot of interviews are very by the book or cookie cutter, and like people ask questions that you kind of expect to be asked, even if you're not told ahead of time. Like you can kind of expect certain questions to be asked, and I like ones that don't necessarily do that because those like cookie cutter questions are things that people talk about constantly because they're on every interview. And interview questions that are not cookie cutter are unique and they make the interview unique and they make the experience unique. So,
well, I try to stay pretty far away from cookie cutter questions. Here's one that I think doesn't come up very often. I've hidden a bomb in your apartment. You have 30 seconds to defuse it or I will activate this detonator. What's your plan?
Okay. I'd probably.
Are you sitting there? Go.
Throw it out the window.
Go. I mean, we are the dumpling dude, so it was only a matter of time, although it took us 93 episodes of dumpling talk, to get to our ultimate tier list. That's right, we are finally going to rank every single dumpling. And now you might be thinking, well, pierogi person, there's only so many dumplings out there. How could you do that? Well, thankfully, we have a rather open-minded definition of what constitutes a dumpling. And believe it or not, pretty much every culture on Earth has their own version of a dumpling.
Right, so we've selected basically one per sort of area of the world, I suppose you could say. And we're going to walk through all of these different dumpling variations, but we're going to be talking about these in tiers and kind of ranking them as they relate to each other, as well as just food in general. And if you'd like to see our finalized official Dumpling Dudes tier list,
That's right. Patrons of the Bento Box tier or higher will get access to our sorted tier list in beautiful art. We've got our artist working up something really awesome for us. So definitely jump into Patreon if you aren't already there and you want access to this tier list. But Ben, we're starting off our journey with our dumplings here in, you guessed it, South America with the empanada. So if you aren't familiar, an empanada is essentially a type of baked or fried turnover consisting of a pastry and some form of filling. A lot of empanadas have a meat-based filling with various different vegetables or filling types that kind of get added into the meat mixture. And personally, I'm a fan. I mean, I grew up, my mother's Brazilian, so I have kind of tasted of the South American style of empanada, and I'm a big fan. The ones we make from Brazil are typically beef, ground beef inside of the pastry, and have hard-boiled egg, olives, onion, and a handful of bits of seasoning, salt, pepper, some different things like cayenne or paprika and that sort of thing. And they're delicious. Absolutely love them.
Now, it's important to note that the difference between empanadas you might find in like Mexico versus the empanadas you might find in, say, the Philippines, where I believe they were carried by Spanish colonists. And if my memory serves me correctly, I'm pretty sure Filipino empanadas end up having a thinner, flakier crust and almost more like a pastry.
And we know, too, that the fillings are typically different between a more Asian-style empanada. While the crust could be relatively similar to a South American one, the filling actually from, say, as you mentioned, a Filipino empanada might have some other starches like potato. They also typically use some form of soy sauce and oyster sauce to kind of mix in with the mixture in there to give more of that sort of Asian flavor palette that you might come to expect from other foods in that cuisine type. But yeah, both amazing options. I think no matter where you're going to get your empanadas, you're going to have a good experience. So long as they have a good crisp crust, the shell has to be crisp. If it's soggy, you know, you're really doing yourself a disservice and that's not a pleasurable experience. But if we're talking about like the prim, proper, well-made empanada, no matter where you're getting it from, where are we rating this on? Oh, and we didn't even mention our tier sort of scale, right? So S tier being like top of the line, can't beat it, best dumpling you've ever had. And then F tier being awful, never want to taste it again. Why are these still being made? And then we fill in with letter grades in between.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a pretty clear S, right? Yeah. Like just empanadas just overall, just they've got to be in the S tier. They're just fantastic. We love them. Yeah, I know personally, we specifically love them. So they just belong in S, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No question. S tier for sure for empanadas. No argument mm-hmm. for me there. And I guess I'll take this next one. Being the gyoza guy, we are moving to Japan with the gyoza. And so gyoza, if you are also not familiar, is a specific type of Japanese dumpling, recognizable thanks to its common crescent shape. Often they are steamed or pan fried. You can get them either or. And typically filled with pork and cabbage and sometimes other vegetables as well, like carrot and things like that. And you can get them with other fillings. Shrimp gyoza is a relatively common version of the gyoza as well. But pork is the go-to traditional sort of filling for a gyoza.
Yeah. Now, these are the ones that you can often find in grocery stores pretty much all over the world in the frozen section. And when prepared well, these can be, you know, a solid dinner or a nice snack, especially if you can, you know, nicely steam them at home or maybe both steam and fry them.
Correct. Yeah. And I personally prefer them pan fried. I like the texture differential between the fried edge. You get that little bit of crispiness, but then the rest of the wrapper is still kind of soft. And then mixed with the typically softer filling, I tend to like the change in textures there. But steamed works just as well. And it's a little bit of a healthier option given that you're not frying the dumplings in oil. But I actually have a personal goal that any time I go to a restaurant that serves gyoza, I have to order it if I've never had it from that restaurant. Keep a list of all the places I've been and rating all the gyoza and such. So perhaps we'll walk through my tier list of just gyoza in a later episode of the Dumpling Dudes. But I'm a big fan. Gyoza's top of the list for me. I mean, to be honest, I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it there. I've got to throw gyoza in the S tier.
Yeah, let's be honest. Gyoza is S tier. Despite being the cause of many a young chef's fire alarms going off, I'd say I would honestly put gyoza in S tier. They've just wound up there.
Absolutely.
Now, next up, we've got pierogies from Poland. Pierogies are, of course, filled dumplings made by wrapping unleavened dough around a savory or sweet filling and cooking in boiling water. Sometimes as well, pan fried before serving. So, I mean, you can get all sorts of fillings for this, although sometimes it's potatoey. Sometimes you wind up with bacon inside. It could be cheesy. It could have even vegetable filling, depending on it. Again, often found in grocery stores across the world. And I'll be honest, at any given time, I have at least two boxes of frozen pierogies in my freezer, just in case you need like a nice, quick, easy meal that you know is going to be great. Sometimes I like to put a little bit of garlic salt on top, depending on the flavors that I have going on inside, and maybe garnish with some other vegetables and serve alongside a salad or something like that.
Now, are you a pan-fried pierogi person, or just boil them, drain them, throw them in a bowl and eat them up?
Yeah, I'm pretty much just on the boil and plan. Sometimes I'll even toss like a pat of butter in after I've drained the pot and just kind of get like a nice creamy sauce going, adding some other stuff in there too. Yeah, pierogies, honestly, I mean, we know where these are going to wind up, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I definitely love a good pierogi. I like to make them myself, as I do with most of these. I'm just into cooking, so I tend to like to try to give these a go myself. And I've found the dough's not very difficult to make, but it can sometimes be difficult to work with. And the fillings, depending on the type that you make, don't hold very long. So if you aren't going to be sort of wrapping all of them at once, you may want to not make too much of the filling. I found in the past that like when I make pierogi filling and I leave it in the fridge, it just doesn't really hold up. So it's better, you know, the recommendation would be to make the filling, make the dough, make as many pierogies as possible, then whatever you're not going to eat, just freeze them, because you can freeze them and they'll hold for quite a while. Definite S tier. I just don't have any way to put it any lower than S tier. The Polish know what they're doing with these pierogies.
Exactly. Wow. Dumplings certainly are good, and we are the dumpling dudes, so it makes sense that we'd enjoy them. I should mention it as a little side note. Traditionally, this is sometimes served with like sour cream, which I think is interesting.
Indeed.
And I have had that once or twice. I went to a kind of like a homemade pierogi restaurant while on vacation last year and had that experience for the first time. I believe it was also served alongside applesauce, if I remember correctly.
They can
kind of
be
some differences in flavor and texture.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. The both are pretty common. I actually am a big fan of like a potato pierogi with sour cream. You basically get kind of like a loaded baked potato, but inside of this nice little dumpling wrapper. And yeah
that's true.
All right. From Poland, we're moving back across the world to Puerto Rico to talk about pasteles. And pasteles are made with pork and adobo stuffing encased in a green plantain masa and wrapped in banana leaves. Just delicious. I mean, you can't really go wrong with pork and adobo stuffed in anything, but let alone wrapped in some good sort of basically dough. I mean, masa's pretty close to a dough, right? And wrapped in leaves, like, it's just delicious. I don't really have anything more to add. They're incredible.
Yeah, the first time I had masa, I was surprised. Definitely still a dumpling by our definition, you know. And of course, we here on Dumpling Dudes, we know the definition of a dumpling, as we've spent, God, how many episodes just covering the definition of a dumpling itself. But so long as it is fully enclosed on all sides by some sort of a doughy or proteiny exterior, and then with some sort of traditional filling or other things inside, as long as it can be enclosed, then we do define it to be a dumpling, of course. So, you know, all over across the world, we see slight differences in the dumpling exterior itself. But masa is an interesting one.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's just another awesome use case for plantains. I mean, if you have not explored the different ways to use a plantain, there are so many different ways to make plantains, and masa is another great application of that particular fruit. I'm a big fan, especially, you know, if you like the sort of South Central American sort of flavor palette, you're going to love pasteles and especially the adobo, right? So I'm going to have to go ahead and just throw this in the S tier. I mean, it's in good company. It's a delicious, delicious dumpling, and S tier is where it belongs.
Yep, agree. Solid S tier. I'm just going to slam that right in there.
All right. So from there, we're going to head west into Central America, where we are taking.
All right. So a little bit of a meta question here. And sure, maybe it's cheating, but it's a fun one. So what's one question that you'd love to be asked in an interview, but never actually have been?
That's a good question. I actually have said to some interviewers in the past, try not to ask me any questions that I've been asked before. Depending on, I didn't say anything like that to you guys, because I've heard your show and I have full confidence in the quality of your work. But I have had a few ones that I guested on where I got the list of questions and I was like, oh my God, trying like this. It's literally it's practically, how do you spell your name? Like how tall are, it's like, come on, let's get interesting. What do I wish I've been asked? How about this? This is not my most wish to be asked. I'm just trying to be clever here with myself. I would say something that people don't ever ask about are areas that you don't think you're doing well in. Everybody always asks, you got the big numbers or your favorite thing or your most popular thing. But what about, where do you think you lack? Where do you think it is that you lack in the work that you do, that you want to do better on, or that maybe you can't do better on, that you simply, we can't be perfect in all things.
Mm. Now, this is the part where we
ask the question. Sure. Yeah. I can add, but see, unlike you asking me what's something about myself that I love and I struggle with, if you ask what's something about your work that you acknowledge sucks, gentlemen, please have a seat. Step into my chamber. I would definitely say that I have reached an awareness that as a Magic the Gathering content creator, I'm not actually very good at Magic the Gathering. And I don't have a lot of insight into gameplay itself. One way in which I have compensated. So when I started out, I was literally showing the decks that I played at Friday Night Magic. Hey, here's my modern deck that I'm playing, and here's my standard deck. And I reached the well of my own knowledge pretty quick. I did some research. So, for example, my video on an introduction to draft, I am not personally someone who drafts frequently. I do draft. I like it. But I took what I knew and I did some research into how to form and craft a good introductory lesson for somebody that's never drafted before, how to draft. And that's a thing I can handle. I can do research. I'm a former teacher. I can do some research into basics. But I lack a kind of instinct for the higher aspects of Magic gameplay. And I often feel bad about that. You know, I look with a great deal of both admiration, and he's a friend of mine, and envy towards someone like Saffron Olive, who has a steel mind when it comes to this stuff. And I know Seth, we're very friendly, and I love him a lot. And he's a very, by the way, just in terms of person, he's a teddy bear. He's the nicest, sweetest guy who is always, I always hate when everybody, you know, when you're popular, people do put a bullseye on you a lot. And he's someone who is like, oh, I don't want to upset anyone. And it's funny that people sometimes hurl like he's some kind of rabble rouser, but it's often with like sideboard comments like, hey, you shouldn't sideboard this. And the people are like, ah, you shit stirrer. And it's like, what do you do? But, you know, he's just talking about a sideboard or something or such. But he's someone who has a real brilliant and coming from a different perspective mind from outside the game. And I really wish I possessed that, but I don't. And I never will. I don't have that. And I've leaned into it. You know, I've been making jokes about how, you know, I don't get caught winning on camera too often, if ever, having just started a gameplay show. And I do win when I play. I just, it's, you know, more often than not, I don't. And so that's going to very likely be what gets recorded. And I'll lean into it. But I do feel like it's unfortunate, as I want to do the thing I'm most proud of in my life is this channel and what I've accomplished, because I was someone who was always told I would never accomplish anything. And I always felt that was true. Like being a community college English professor, anyone can do that. You just got to go through college, you check off the classes, you just do it, you go in, here's how you write an essay. And I always felt like such a loser. And what I built with this channel is something so unique to me, and something that came from what I poured into it came back, and it's so personal. And so with it, I want to do everything. It's why I do everything on the channel. I want to do comedy skits. I want to do gameplay. I want to do product reviews. I want to interview Mark Rosewater. I want to do all those things. And I got to do all those things. And I want to do more. And so then it's like, but there's a limit. There's a ceiling, isn't there? And it's like, you know what? Yeah. You're not really good at magic. Despite it all, you're a creative type. You're a passionate type. You can see quality. And I really believe that while that a lot of people who play this game great, maybe some of the best players in the world, doesn't mean they're entertaining to watch. And I maybe suck at magic, but I think I can be entertaining to watch. And so, yeah, but definitely that's one area I'm aware of. I will never be the brilliant mind of magic. I'll have to settle for its heart and soul, perhaps. And I'd like to think that. I think magic needs a little bit of like we were talking about a little early on. Some people maybe could stand to relax a little bit and have fun. And I think I'm a little bit about that passion of the game, less so than skill of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what we're all about, right? Like when we started this, we were like, we don't want to focus on the spiky stuff. We can, you know, folks can listen to Marshall Sutcliffe for that. Like, you know, they have a great draft show that does that. We want to be a little bit more on the
And that's I think that's great. Yeah. No, if I did end up on Ravnica, I would be in the Izzet Guild, but I would probably be a mono red card because I'm all passion and impulse. I like those blue qualities, but I more possess that red fiery passion side of creation.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And honestly, you mentioned kind of like all these almost like spinning plates that you balance with doing all these different aspects. You do it well. Like you pull it off. And if you didn't, you wouldn't be the most popular Magic the Gathering YouTube channel, would you?
Well, all you have to do is spend 9 years working 6 to 7 days a week from morning till night. And there you go.
Overnight success.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow.
So you mentioned teaching and a bit of your
background. All right. So that wraps up our player archetypes, our opponent archetypes in Arena. On to FNM. And we're starting off FNM with Perpetually in the Pack, Paul.
Oh yeah. This is like, I remember I probably heard someone say this like my very first draft. And I don't think I've not heard it since. Just about once per draft, if you've drafted in store, you will hear someone in your pod say something along the lines of, "Why is this still in the pack?" They're like, "I can't believe this is still going around," or "Wow, I really wield this. You're all dumb." Like, they don't say that last part, but that is the not so subtle subtext. Someone that says, "I can't believe this is still in the pack," is, I don't know, they're doing a few things. They're both trying to flex their own supposed format knowledge, which, if they don't say what the card is, could be incorrect and might just be incorrect from the start. They're trying to flex to say that, like, oh, I know better than the table, right? Like, I believe this card should have gone earlier. And in doing so, you kind of insult everyone else. You say, oh, well, you didn't take this. You're dumb, right? Like, if you didn't pick this card, you're an idiot. I mean, this obviously ignores a whole bunch of draft basics, right? Maybe people opened some must-play bombs so they didn't pivot into a color or, I don't know. If this is like pick three of pack one and someone says like, oh, I can't believe this is still here. Maybe the people just had better cards in the pack, right? Like, I mean, people know how to draft. There's usually a good chance they took stuff that was right. And yeah, maybe sometimes a bomb does slip through the cracks. Maybe someone didn't study the format or just came to have fun. Just to like, don't be a jerk about it, you know?
Yeah. And I think a lot of times this tends to happen as well when like, only one or maybe like one and a half players are drafting a given vector. And so like nobody else wants the card that is very good for that person's deck. And they see it and they're like, how is this still in the pack? Because I'm wheeling these awesome cards that are good for my deck. Nobody else wants those cards because they're not drafting those colors or that vector or whatever, you know? So there's also a little bit of that in there where you're, I feel like a lot of the times when we hear that, the person who's saying it has a little bit of a warped mentality around the deck that they're building.
Yeah. And like, you can do this in a positive light. You can, there's a way to be excited about wheeling a card that doesn't put other people down, right? You can be like, wow, I can't believe I wheeled this like perfectly on vector card. This is exciting. Like, my deck is better. I'm going to have a good time. We do this in the Draft Discord, right? Like, we post things that we can't believe made it back to us. And it's like a good thing, right? Because it means we're going to get to draft a good deck. And that's kind of what we like to do, right? But if you're doing it with the express purpose of insulting everyone else at your table and insinuating that they don't know how to draft, or that you know the format better than them, or that you have some secret that they don't know, it's the worst when you don't even tell them like what the card is, right? Then it's like, well, who cares? You may as well just like raise your hand and go, actually, I'm better than all of you. It's like, come on, perpetuating the pack, Paul. Get out of here.
Yeah, I think also one thing to mention here too is that like there are folks out there who genuinely who say this with the intent of trying to help. Like they aren't doing it maliciously. Yeah. They don't realize that it is something that actually insults people at the table. So I would offer if you find yourself in that spot, a better way to approach this would be wait till the draft is over, then find the person who passed to you and say, hey, what else was in this pack? Because I was really surprised to see this card. And from there, you can have a conversation about why they didn't take the card. And maybe you can help out a newer player in that way by saying, oh, here's why I would have taken this over that. Maybe think about that in your next draft or something. But you're not just like ousting people in front of the entire group. And you're not making it come off as if you are the smartest person at the table.
Yeah. Now, if you have someone like this at your pod, honestly, best thing to do, just stay silent. Speak up, obviously, if they're like literally insulting other people. You don't want to have someone come away with like a bad experience. Call people out if they're being like overtly rude to people. But if it's just someone kind of being snooty and know it all about like the format, maybe just ignore them. The attention might be what they want. And obviously, like Zach mentioned, there's better ways to go about doing this. If like you wanted to talk to someone about a pick, just be polite about it. Now, our next one, Rip and Flip Rick. I don't know if everyone out there knows who Rip and Flip Rick is, but it's someone that I was introduced to very early in my career at my Rutgers Magic Club, actually. So this is probably more common among the younger crowds, but it's an old practice. I think it's mostly died out. It's not fun to see. So basically what will happen, someone might take like a pack of cards that they won or bought or something. They will open the pack. They will not look at the rare/mythic slot. And they will rip it in half and without looking at it. And then they will flip it over to see what the card was. And sometimes it's chaff and it's useless and it's everyone gets a good laugh. Sometimes it's a chase mythic and everyone gets a questionably bigger laugh. I don't know. This
not,
is
everybody. Not everybody.
Not everybody. Now, I remember thinking like when I was first starting out, just learning to like really draft and play the game and still building a collection. I remember seeing people ripping and flipping at the time. It was Lily Last Hope, I believe, was the one that it was like a big player in Standard. That one, like I saw it get ripped and flipped. And I saw people rip and flip other like big things just from other packs. Someone ripped and flipped an Emrakul. I've seen other ones on Twitter and Reddit of rip and flip cards, like taped back together. I'm sure people could look this up if they wanted to find them. Honestly, I get it. Like, it's funny. But on the other hand, I don't know. The older I've thought about it, the older I've gotten, the more I've thought about it, the more I think, like, just destroying the game pieces that could go to other people, I don't know. Especially having like hosted a club for students where they would get excited over like opening a cool rare. I had a student crack a Goldspan Dragon when it was worth a bunch. It still is. And he thought it was awesome. It was the coolest thing in the world. And I don't know. It's hard to justify that kind of behavior when there's people out there that would honestly put those cards to good use. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's... On the one hand, I'm like, you know, you got the thing, do what you want with your stuff. On the other hand, I'm like, that's just a waste. So I don't find Rip and Flip Rick to be the most offensive player on this list, but it's just kind of weird. And it always feels bad to see somebody rip something valuable, especially when we're doing this with older packs, because some people will do this with packs that aren't in circulation anymore.
Yeah.
And they'll flip like a Lily of the Veil or something from an OG Innistrad pack. And it's just like, why? There are only so many of those left. Like, stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's just disheartening. You know, it's like, well, this is a game. We shouldn't, you know, enjoy playing with it. I don't know. It's funny, I guess. Like you said,
it's funny to watch somebody do, but it also kind of hurts.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious to hear what the listener thinks of this one. Listener, go ahead, hop in the Discord and like, comment, and subscribe if you would rip and flip it. No, actually, just tell us what you think of this practice, or if you've seen this, if you've participated in it, if you have justification. I don't know. Like, I could see how it'd be really fun. It's like a gamble, except it's a gamble where you can only lose. This is like the Russian roulette of Magic, right? If cracking packs is normal gambling, a rip and flip is Russian roulette.
Yeah, I think actually, to your point too, and I think this would be far more like interesting if you didn't just skip right to the rare and rip the rare. Like, it should be Russian roulette-esque where you like shuffle the pack up and you don't know which slot is which, and you may that's rip even the funnier. Rare.
Yeah, okay, so they're not even doing it right. It's still like a kind of like wasteful and maybe slightly tilted.
You're just holding practice, a gun to your head and and pulling the trigger knowing that the round is in the chamber. Like,
well, I guess to really bridge the analogy, you don't know how good a person you are. You don't know if, yikes, I don't like this analogy at all. Anywho.
Let's move on to our next FNM archetype, and that is Salty Sam. Salty Sam is one that I struggle with the most. I don't know how to deal with Salty Sam in the middle of a game. And this is the person, the opponent, who is just getting really upset during a match in the middle of the game, making kind of offhand comments about cards that you're playing, cards that they're not drawing. These are the, like, they make little kinds of, just little like quips about the state of the game and how it's unfair or whatever. I mean, I think this is one that we've all experienced at some point. If you've played any amount of Magic in person, you've probably experienced a Salty Sam, and it's really uncomfortable. I personally don't have a great way to deal with them. I tend to just stay quiet and let them say what they're going to say, or just be like, oh yeah, it sucks. You know, like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. It's like round five of a tournament. Everyone's getting tired, like, making little mistakes, and then that compounds it, and then the person gets even more upset with themselves. I don't know. I recently had an experience where someone, like, as I was playing cards, was like asking, like, oh, like, man, like, who passed you all those cards? Like, where'd you even get a deck like that? And was like clearly not having a good time. We'd play this game to have a good time, right? And like have fun, hopefully, with our friends, and maybe sometimes win and have fun winning.
All right, our next question comes from Ratafia, who asks, if you could have an animal on a Magic card as a pet, which card would it be? Any animal on any Magic card.
All right. Now, this is tough because this would include an animal shown on like a sorcery, not just creature type ones. Right.
Exactly.
I almost feel like that would take too long to comb through literally everything. There's some nice like bird token art that, with like little doves on it. Those would be kind of cool, but I think I'm going to go big here. My runner up is the Gitrog monster, because apparently you can ride it. I know this thanks to Thalia.
Is the Gitrog monster an animal?
I suppose it is.
It is a horror, more of like a, it's frog.
But it's like a frog horror. So I don't know. Maybe.
I count it.
That is the runner up. I'm going to go with Giganta the Wellspring as my true pick, because it's a like 50-foot tall elemental elk that fixes for any color of mana, and it's a companion, so you know it's friendly. Like, I think it has a little bit of everything, but it's mainly red green, but it also has a bit of everything with it. I don't know. It looks like it'd be pretty cool to ride around. I'm sure it could run pretty fast. Those antlers are probably pretty sturdy, so I don't know, build a house up there, have it just kind of walk around like a Howl's Moving Castle type of deal. I don't know. Could be cool. This would be my go-to, I think. Plus, it's an elemental.
Where would you put it?
Well, that's the thing. Because it's an elemental.
You build your house on it. Yeah.
I have a feeling it could like probably change its size, or like shrink into a, turn into a fine mist, or I don't know. It's a five-color elemental. It could probably do some pretty cool stuff. It's not really explained in the lore, but...
Yeah.
Plus, it's an elk.
I don't think I ever realized how big it is.
Yeah. I mean, those are like the Ikoria crystals around it.
Yeah. And things gigantic.
Yeah. Gigantic.
Gigantha.
Boo.
Yeah. So I had two that came to mind. The first for me was Empyrean Eagle, because if you've been a listener to the show for a while, you know I love birds. And I also love spirits as a creature type. It's the deck I play in Modern. It's one of my favorite subtypes for creatures, if not my favorite. And so to kind of put the two in one, and then also just thinking about having a pet, like it's a spirit, so I don't have to deal about cleaning up after it. I don't have to feed it.
Probably doesn't eat.
I wouldn't have to feed it. It wouldn't like make a mess of my living space. And I'm choosing to believe that it could make itself corporeal if it wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So such that like it. I could actually pet it and stuff. Well, I don't even know how big this thing is. I guess it looks pretty big in the art relative to the other
birds,
but
yeah, those are like swallows. Small. Even if those are swallows, yeah. this thing is
it's
probably
an eagle,
pretty
so
big.
It's going to be pretty big, but
yeah,
I don't think it's any bigger than like a golden eagle we would see on Earth, which are quite big. They have like 20-foot wingspans, but yeah. And also the flavor text for it: all the birds of the skies are the spirit's brood, gathered for safety under its wings. So it's a protector. It's, you know, it cares for its own, and I think that would be useful.
It would probably eat your runner up.
Yeah, the runner up for me actually. Ben is only seeing the art that I'm about to put on screen for you as well here. The card itself is not the runner up. It's actually, so the card is Basking Capybara, but the actual runner up is the little Velociraptor bird guys.
Oh,
the Archaeopteryx bird guys that are in the art for this.
Clever. I didn't think of this. This makes sense though. Yeah. You tell me that the Capybara isn't involved in your list at all. This would be top 10 for me.
I don't care. I don't know. I would rather have the birds than a rodent, a gigantic rodent.
Yeah, it's true. These things are probably messy, but it could live outdoors. And I mean, look at it.
Not where I live. It couldn't.
No. Yeah, that's true. No such thing as outdoors there. Although it'd be kind of funny to take one of these things for a walk in the city.
That would be pretty hilarious.
Get some good looks.
I'm sure I've seen weirder things in the city.
Oh, this wouldn't even crack top 10. I'm not even sure this would crack top 10 of things on a leash that I've seen in the city.
That's terrifying.
Up next from Mikey S, what are your favorite vintage cube archetypes? Thanks for the question, Mikey. I love vintage cubes. So before I ramble, let's let Zach have a chance to get a word in.
Yeah, I don't play a ton of vintage cube. I know, gasp, but
tisk tisk.
The decks that I've seen the most of, that like the ones that I enjoy the most just watching them play out and the draft experience, probably blue-white Cheons and whatever like pseudo infinite mana blue artifact decks LSV puts together.
Have you been watching his daily drafts?
No, not his recent ones, but I usually will catch up with them like later on, and I've seen a bunch of his old ones, and yeah, they're all just phenomenal.
Yeah, he knows his stuff for sure. I would say, okay, so if I had to tier list these, I'm not even sure I could. I think it's better if I just kind of mention a couple vectors that I like the most. By the way, we did make a Vintage Cube episode titled How to Cheat in Vintage Cube. And all the Vintage Cube decks that I like the most are ones where you are cheating. I would say probably Mono White and Mono Red are my two favorites, because I like just, you know, getting in there, smacking face. Those, I will say, with a piece of power, like just a good mono white deck with even an off color Mox. Just that is great. And like an Armageddon. So you go like one drop into Thalia, into two drop into, I don't know, maybe they've killed Thalia at this point, and then you can Armageddon on four, or you top deck your ramp piece and something like that. Something that really just gets in quick. My other favorite is one where you dump your entire hand on turn one and then cast a Wheel of Fortune or cast a Time Twister, or like a High Tide deck where your mana is tapping for multiple and then you untap it all with, I don't know, like Turnabout or Frantic Search, any of these like Time Spiral, any of these nonsense type of decks I really like. Something that you might conventionally call Storm, but the Storm decks these days don't really look like what they might have at one point. It's not really about the ritual, like Dark Ritual, Pyretic Ritual, those types of things. And then like casting a Past in Flames and then a Grape Shot. We've come a long way since then. We have technology. Now it's more about Underworld Breach, Lion's Eye Diamond, and Brain Freeze. Something like putting together those combos, or just, you know, drawing your whole deck and casting a Thassa's Oracle. So kind of the two big ends of the spectrum. Another one that I do like a lot is lands. If you're able to get like an early exploration or fast bond, and then you can just find a lot of ways to interact with lands like strip mine and a lot of fetch lands. Omnath goes well in this type of deck. Renin 6. Yeah, these I would say are my favorites. Some of the other ones out there, like Reanimator. Reanimator's fun. It's fine, but it's not really unique to the Vintage Cube. Like, we have a very solid Reanimator vector in our cube. It's not something that I go to seek out a unique experience there for. Whereas something like lands, that really only exists in the Vintage Cube. That doesn't show up in like any other draft experience. So that's one that I value pretty highly. I'll take a fast bond, pack one, pick one over a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and to be clear, the artifacts, the blue artifacts decks I'm talking about are really the ones that are just like, you have a bunch of rocks and upheaval, and that's like your whole win condition.
Yeah, like Talarian Academy, or something. Paradoxical Outcome. Like, yeah, those are a lot of fun.
So our next question here comes from Dorigan, who asks, what card not currently on Arena do you want included in Arena?
Ooh, they have they've done a lot of good work recently with the fetch lands. Those would have been my answer had they not been just added recently. Timeless has been a lot of fun. I've been playing some pretty good decks. I've been playing a Death and Taxes list with Thalia and Orcish Bowmasters. It's a lot of fun. Hit Mythic with that deck, actually. Really strong. So I can no longer say the fetch lands, that they did eventually get around to it. And another one that I would say, this is sort of cheating, but the Power Nine, because they are on Arena. They're just not
right.
They're just not on Arena. I would love to see the Power Nine on there so that we could do like an Arena Vintage Cube, because even just with a lot of the cards we have on there now, the like Ragavan's on there. Boom. You have a Vintage Cube tier red deck with just Ragavan and a bunch of other nonsense. Like that's all you really need. So are the Power Nine currently on Arena? Technically, I guess we'll say no.
Yeah, I would say no. You can't collect them, and there's no environment where you can like actually play with them regularly.
Yeah, I think it might be cool if some of the old Alara sets were on Arena. So this is sort of like a multi-card pack rather than a single card. There are some cards from Alara that those are the draft sets that I've never experienced. I don't know if they're good or bad or anything in between. But it seems like it'd be a cool experience, and we're kind of pushing back to that era, right? Where we have some of the newer stuff, and we're just kind of getting older and older and older. I expect we'll never get like Alpha on Arena, but the Alara block does seem like a reasonable thing to have included on there someday, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting because I've read a post recently that came from Morrow, and he said basically the only reason that Khans was added was because it was the first set they programmed into the game when they were building an Alpha.
Interesting.
So that was just the set they chose to start like testing with the game with before it was even playable by anybody outside of WotC. And so they mostly had it already done. And so it was a very short, very small lift to get it into the game.
Just needed the once
over. I don't
know
how much I believe that, because I feel like it would have come out much sooner if that were actually the case.
Yeah.
I also get kind of confused with comments like that, because when they first like announced Arena, they made a big deal about saying that the way they built the engine was such that adding new sets was largely trivial.
I seem to remember that too. Yeah.
And now it feels like every few sets they're like, this took some massive feat of programming to get in here.
It's because they keep making wacky cards and alchemy designs. That's why they're making cards with five sides to them.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the last big one was like Emrakul, but obviously Emrakul is like an edge case, I guess. Anyway, I feel like Arena's gotten to a point now with the sets that they've added, like we're pretty close to Pioneer. Like all like Pioneer legal cards being on. And so I can't really think of an individual card that I wish was on Arena that isn't.
Cruel Ultimatum, final answer.
Is Cruel Ultimatum not on the game?
No. And that's from Alara. Unless they added one of these random.
Yeah, it's the original Ultimatum.
Masters. I mean, they've done a good job like adding a lot of these random historic anthologies and other anthologies that include some of the cards from modern Masters sets and even others. Like having Deathrite Shaman on there is awesome for Timeless. Honestly, the fact that we can't think of too many off the top of our heads, pretty good sign.
Yeah, and I mean, that probably has something to do with the environments we play. Like, as limited players, like, first and foremost, I don't really care what cards are available in the game to craft or, like, build decks with. As someone who does occasionally play Constructed, the formats that I play and the decks that I like to play pretty much are already there. Maybe Aether Vial would be the card I would want.
Yeah, that makes sense for you.
Yeah, but otherwise, like, I'm pretty happy with where it's at, and I feel like, unless you are big on, like, Legacy or something, and before we can get four-player Commander, I don't have a whole lot of requests.
Man, forget Time Walk or Dig Through Time. That was more like a time stretch. That was 4 years of Draft Chaff. Man, Time Seep? Yeah. Is that one?
It's something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of wild that we've been doing this for 4 years, and, you know, all great things do come to an end eventually. Who's to say this is a permanent end? It may not be, and I'm not closing that door entirely, or at least I'm not locking it. And so there's definitely potential for it to come back. But normally at this point, we would be doing a listener question of the week. Again, if you want to hear that, click that YouTube link in the episode description. Go check out Ben's video where he'll cover that, as well as that Cracker Draft type thing. But with that, Teferi Tybalt.
Yeah, time for one last Teferi Tybalt. This is also on YouTube, but I think it's important we get one last Teferi Tybalt from Zach.
Yeah, so this is our Roses and Thorns style segment where we share a high and a low from the past week. Ben, how's it going? What's up?
Well, I've got some Teferis, got some Tybalts. Teferi, I mean, I'm excited for the future of Draft Chaff, right? We're still drafting Chaff out here, and I'm excited to dust off my YouTube video editing skills, which have atrophied a bit since high school, but we'll see what I can whip up over there. I think there's going to be some fun stuff ahead, and don't worry, I'll drag you onto there at some point. Don't think you've gotten out fully. Tybalt, it's hard not to say that the show ending in its typical form isn't a Tybalt. I think it is, but I think it's also it's bittersweet, right? As all things like this are. And my other Tybalt this week is that you know how I top four two RCQs
in a row? Yeah.
Yeah. This past weekend I played in one more, and there were 11 players and I didn't top eight. That's how bad it went.
Nice. There you have it, listener. It doesn't always go Ben's way.
Look, the pendulum swung the other direction. I could have gone 1-1 and double draw, and I could have top eighted with that record, and I could not win a single match. I opened one of the worst sealed pools in my entire life in the tournament where I had to basically just win one match. I had to not lose two matches. That's basically all that had to happen. But nah, it was, I think I opened like three lands, Coveted Falcon, the green mythic that brings like lands back from your graveyard. It just some utter garbage. And I played like a five color bad deck, and I played against a five color good deck. And it's just, my opponent played Rakdos, while my rare that I was splashing for was like Itrada, which is good, but like you can't really curve into it if you're playing base green white. It was a mess. Felt bad about that one. Might give it one more shot this weekend. At this point, I honestly don't even know.
I didn't realize that they were running this many in a row back to back of the same format. Is that normal?
Yeah. Well, these are all different stores. I've been bouncing around.
Sure.
Apparently there's basically every week. I've been using spicerack.gg. It's like a tournament tracking app. I highly recommend it out there. We're not sponsored by them or anything. I don't think they do that, but they're a great site. 17 lands and Spice Rack. I got them both bookmarked in the same folder. They're good resources to have for people that like playing tournaments. They do. And there's one more this weekend, and then the season ends. And then I think there's no more until Outlaws comes out. And then the next season will be Outlaws of Thunder Junction, I think more towards the early summer. So I'll be taking a bit of a competitive hiatus, but that'll give me time to update the cube and focus on YouTube a bit and see what's up.
Sweet. Can't wait.
All right. Over to you, Teferi and Tybalt. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with the Tybalt, I guess. The show ending is a Tybalt. I'm not going to say it's not. Yeah, I think you hit it on the, the nail on the head there, Ben, with it's bittersweet. Like, I am excited to have the time to do other things and not kind of feel like I have to do the show because it's like out of obligation, but that like I can do something else that like I'm excited to do, because I think that's where it's gotten, right? I mentioned in last week's episode that it started to become a little bit of a chore. But it is a tibble. It's been the last 4 years. It's been something that's kept you and I like in really good like communication. Like we see each other regularly. We talk to each other every week for the last 4 years. And so we're going to have to find a way to make sure that we continue to do that. But
yeah.
From a Teferi perspective, it's kind of a new chapter for both of us. And I think that's going to be really cool. I'm excited to see what you do with the brand and the show as a whole, what it looks like on YouTube in terms of like, how it changes, how it evolves, how the community continues to grow, because right, that's not going anywhere. And I think just looking back on the show over the last 4 years and how we've grown as hosts of a show, our ability to put a show together, the way the community's grown, like well beyond anything we ever imagined it possibly could have been, that's all incredible. And so like, yeah, it does feel like I'm kind of leaving a bit of a legacy. There is a little part of me that is like already kind of feeling FOMO for what's coming for the show. But that's also exciting. So, overall, like, thanks to everybody who's listened to the show, even just once. It's been a really awesome journey, and it's been really fun to get to talk to you folks in the Discord and, make new friends. Honestly, I mean, I feel like I am friends with most of you who are in the Discord. So, if you've been listening and you haven't been in the Discord, again, highly, highly recommend it. It's a great group of people over there. And I guess I won't say goodbye, but I'll say so long.
Yep. Nah, that's how it goes. I totally agree. This community is awesome, and I can't imagine letting it loose and just and being like, so long, people. I don't think Draft Chaff as an entity is going anywhere anytime soon. So, well, it changes as all things do. Well, what's that thing? Everything stays, but everything changes at the same time. So, let's see what comes next.
Well, that about does it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Again, do check out the Discord if you haven't already. The link to that is in the episode description. Check out Patreon if you'd like to support Ben and his endeavors going forward with Draft Chaff. At patreon.com/draftchaffpod. We're still over there on Twitter or X at draftchaffpod. And check out that YouTube link. It's in the episode description. You're not going to want to miss that. Go subscribe. Make sure you're not missing any of the episodes that Ben puts out. Ben, do you want to give like a quick summary of thoughts on what you think you're planning for what that's going to look like?
There's going to be a lot more drafting of chaff. We'll say that. That's all I'm going to hint at here.
All right. And obviously you'll be getting video content. So that's good too.
Yeah. Yeah. People have been asking for this for a while. It's like seeing more of the actual gameplay, because we do lots of Kraken drafts, but honestly, gameplay is kind of my strength. I've got like an 85% win rate in this format right now, in best of three matches. So, I mean, hey, you could do it too. A little bit of vector theory, a little bit of drafting chaff. That's all it takes.
Who knows? Maybe if things kick off really well for you over there on YouTube land, you could be a streamer for a living.
Oh man, I don't know about that.
Then you will have to swallow the fact that you're a content creator once in a while.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could ever reconcile that properly. I don't know if I'd last. My brain might implode.
Well, thank you so much for listening, folks. See you.